Welcome to the Tennis Worthy podcast presented by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber, and this week we are excited to talk with an Australian legend, Hall of Famer Mark Woodford.
At that time, I think I was probably one or two in my age group, but these other guys got selected. My dad did turn around and say, prove them wrong. Prove them that it was a mistake. And, you know, it doesn't mean to say that you can't keep going, young fella. It was like he got nose to nose with me and he said, so you think you're good enough to play doubles with me? I said, no, but I'm going to give it a try. He said, well, you better hold your end up, and just turned and walked off out of the lock, dropped his bag and walked out. I, you know, really pride myself in the singles, that knowing that I had beaten the McEnroes, the Lendls, the Connors, the Edbergs, ended up beating Agassi and Sampras, but two guys that I never beat. We didn't end up winning the tournament, but the matches that we won, we knew that there was this incredible chemistry that continued right until the final match.
Alongside fellow Aussie Todd Woodbridge, Mark won 11 of his 12 Grand Slam titles in doubles, but he actually started out committed to becoming a top singles player, traveling far from his native Adelaide to develop as a junior. In Mark's candid conversation with our host, Chris Bowers, he talks about how his first slam title, partnered with John McEnroe, taught him how to play elite-level doubles. Mark also reveals how he and Todd Woodbridge became the dominant team known as the Woodies, despite their differences. He also talks about his belief in hard work and focusing on the positive, plus his top 20 singles career and the emotional moment when he learned he and Todd would become Hall of Famers. I leave you now with our host, Chris Bowers, and Mark Woodford. Chris, take it away.
Mark, what particular quality do you think makes you a Hall of Famer?
I think belief, never say die attitude. I don't think I'm an outwardly confident person, but I think I reassured myself. I had a passion for this sport, and I felt like if I put the work in, there was going to be rewards. And I felt like, looking back, I put my head down and went about it. And I think if you ask Todd Ruff, Muddy, who was a part of our team, our unit.
Ray Ruffles and Mark Waters.
Mark Waters, yep. That I might have got my butt kicked on a particular day. And the score might have been 6-1, 6-1. And, yeah, you know, pretty heavy loss. But I would look at it, I lost. I got well and truly beaten. But there were two games that I did something right. And I wanted to build upon those two games. And I got back out there the next day. And Todd said, you know, it would take me a day or 2 days to recover. And he said, you were back out there the next day. And like you've never had that loss in that week. I just went about my routine in that manner.
Did you always have that belief in other things, maybe in subjects at school or other hobbies that you did? Or was tennis the activity where you discovered that's actually where I really do believe?
Well, I wasn't very studious. You know, I got by, you know, with my education. So I feel like that sports was, you know, going to be significant in my life and future at that time. You know, a lot of the phys ed teachers were, you know, you're pretty handy in every sport that we go out and attempt. So I grew up playing, you know, Aussie rules footy. I played cricket. I played basketball, combination with tennis. And eventually tennis became the focus, I think, because the other sports started to clash with some of the tennis commitments. But I just started to excel. And as a junior, I think from 10 years of age, probably up until about 13, 14, I was the leader in our age groups. I was the number one in our age groups. And then, of course, you go through change, puberty. And some of the other guys started to grow a little quicker than me. They added a bit more sting on the ball. And, you know, I kind of became one of the top four or five in my age group. So I'd kind of gone through this, not a major roller coaster, but a bit of a dip through that period. But I think at the same time, I wanted to keep playing and facing that, we can say now, if it was adversity, that was You know, it was just a knock in the chin. It didn't knock me down.
So what was it that made you choose tennis over Aussie rules, cricket, basketball?
I think the idea also of it was international, Aussie rules, cricket is, and of course basketball. But again, when I was playing basketball, at the start, I was one of the taller guys. And then, of course, you know, later on, again, people would, you know, surpass me with height. And I actually love basketball. But it's actually, you know, a lot of those other sports are hand-eye coordinated sports, like tennis. And so I was able to pick, I felt like I picked up those other sports very quickly. We were a tennis family. Most weekends, if I wasn't off playing another sport, I was down at our local tennis club. My dad was the club captain and the tennis coach for South Parcombe Tennis Club. And as soon as I finished a cricket match, back to the tennis club I went. I hung out at the tennis club with some really good friends, families that my family were associating with, and we'd spend weekends with. So it was my playground, and it really just grew from there, staying up late, watching tennis on TV. I don't think I was glued to the TV always watching cricket or Aussie rules or basketball. I really wanted to watch Wimbledon played. I wanted to see, you know, Roland Garros, the times that it got on TV, and the US Open.
So you were most passionate about tennis?
I think my heart was really behind tennis, yeah.
We notice in tennis, in other sports, in all walks of life, that you get clusters of people from a certain area, often because there is an inspirational figure.
Yeah.
And in Adelaide, there was Peter Smith and some very good people, including some of your contemporaries, Darren Cahill, Brod Dyke was a little earlier.
Yep.
Leighton Hewitt.
Sure.
To what extent was that sort of cluster of high-level coaching something that rubbed off on you?
It had a major impact in my age group. And I'm talking, you know, back in our mid-teens, there was Darren Cahill, Peter Carter, Anthony Lane, Todd Viney and myself. So we were all from Adelaide, and we all were in the state squad and trained together. And then the evolution of the Australian Institute of Sport came around. We all had aspired. I said, this is great. We you know, can apply. Hopefully we'll be selected and move to Canberra, and you live most of the year there and get all of this fantastic training that is going to be provided. I wasn't selected. I was actually, at that time, I think I was probably one or two in my age group, but these other guys got selected. It bothered me for sure, but it didn't deter me.
Did it spur you on?
I'm sure it must have, because I stayed...
You weren't conscious of it.
I stayed in the sport, and whether it was my dad did turn around and say, prove them wrong. You know, prove them that it was a mistake. And, you know, it doesn't mean to say that you can't keep going, young fella. So I you know, basically just stayed back in Adelaide and didn't see, you know, my good mates that, you know, you spend 4, 5, 6 years with. So it kept me involved. And I think that was, again, my outlook was, I'll prove them wrong. Even to the sense of when I eventually traveled overseas with Barry Phillips Moore. And the only reason that I got with Barry, my dad was a very good tennis player when in his time. Unfortunately, he didn't have the finances, his family didn't have the finances to send him away. And back in those days, it was key. If you weren't part of the program, you weren't going anywhere. So,
would you have had the desire to prove them wrong if there hadn't been people around you, in particular your dad, who would have said, come on, fella, you can still make it? Because that could have been it could have ended the hopes of some youngsters.
Absolutely. And I think the motivation for my father was because he didn't have that chance to travel internationally with his tennis. He wanted to ensure that he could do everything to father me, to seeing if I could have that opportunity and progress up. And through his friendship with Barry Phillips Moore, you know, he tapped him and was aware that Barry and his wife Anne were taking, you know, young kids away over to Europe, only to Europe. There was never any discussion about going, through Asia. You know, in fact, Barry warned me off from going coming over to the US at all. Don't go to the collegiate system. It's not ripe. There's great, the coaching isn't there. The level and.
Do you think he was right now that you live in America and the coaching, the collegiate system is fashionable again?
That circle of life goes around, doesn't it? At the time, he was spot on, and I was so happy that I got to go away. But then again, this is the those moments that, you know, whether they motivate you, but I would see my mates from the Institute of Sport traveling in Europe that first, second year. I've been away for 8-9 months because once you go away, when you're privately funded, you go away once for the year. My parents didn't have enough money to, you know, for me to go back and forth. So I, you know, was like homesick. We were in a team though. There were 6-7 other fellas going through the same experiences as what I was. They weren't good enough to be in the national program. So they were being funded by their own parents.
Any of those 7 make it?
No, probably one other, Carl Limburger, who I ended up playing doubles with for a period of time, but the others didn't progress.
So what made you progress when they didn't? Because you were all in the same situation.
Yeah, well, again, when I saw these Institute of Sport guys, they're coming in for 6 weeks to play in Europe, and they were going home. My heart would sink, just that knowledge that they could come away for a short period of time and go home. Then that you'd hear about them going over to the US for 7 weeks and they'd go home. They went to Asia for 4 weeks and then went home. But Barry and Anne kept saying, that's not necessarily the pathway to success. You get spoiled by going home consistently. You all are being exposed to different cultures almost on a weekly basis. You're going to build strength, and from strength, you know, comes belief, and away we go. So golden words from Barry. I always looked at my coach. There was this trust factor that I had in Barry and Anne. To me, he had been there as a tennis player. I wanted to achieve what he did. It was quite simple. I trusted, I believed everything he told me. I wasn't gullible. I probably was a little naive, but why would he, you know, take me in a different direction? So I followed that example, and I just wanted to show these other guys when I got home to Australia how much stronger, not just physically, but probably more mentally, that I had become by spending a long time overseas in my first few years. And I felt like once I got to train like they were, for me, Barry Phillips Moore was just as good as, if not better than, the coaches at the Institute of Sport. Once I could be exposed to that high-level tuition, I was going to surpass them. So I always had this measuring stick from the guys that were in the nationally funded program. And again, go back to, I guess I wanted to prove them wrong. Who ultimately, the guy who made those selections for the Institute of Sport ended up being the Woody's coach, Ray Ruffles. So we laugh about it now. You know, he said, yeah, I didn't think you were worth a cracker. He said, I didn't think you were going to pursue tennis.
Big of him for admitting that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I've always got along well with Ruff, the honesty that existed with him as well. But he said, you know, it's not always the case where they select people in these programs because it is a catalyst for some of them to, I'm going to prove them wrong. There's not always just this, well, not only one path to success. There are these multiple pathways. And so I was just on a different highway compared to some of the other guys, my teammates.
So at 18, you turned professional. And by 20, you had won the tour event in Adelaide. Mm. Did that feel like sort of coming full circle? Did that feel like justifying all the doubts, the setbacks, the which sport do I go for that you've been through your childhood?
Any time that you have that success, a tournament victory, I think you feel like you've succeeded. There's that level of I've made it. The first time that I won Adelaide, that was my actual second tournament, though. I'd won Auckland not too much before that. And that was the real impact for me because I did feel like I had made it. At winning Adelaide, I felt like I was rewarding my family, my friends, back in Adelaide. See, I have continued on, and I'm winning an international tournament. I was one of those little kids that were there watching me play in Adelaide. I'd been in their shoes as a youngster myself. I'd ball boyed for the Adelaide International Tournament many times. I had seen all these great players come through. That helped, you know, keep my belief that that's what I wanted to do. I want to become these guys. And so I felt like, wow, you know, hopefully there are these young kids that are here at Memorial Drive watching me win, that I've maybe set some of their dreams up. Whenever you win at home, it's such an injection of pride. And I went back and won it at second year as well.
So. Yes, you defended your title.
Yeah.
You won your first Grand Slam doubles, men's doubles title with John McEnroe. How did that partnership come about, and what did you learn from him in particular?
Partnering John was just, you know, coincidence. I think right place, right time. I'd played him in back-to-back tournaments, Toronto, the Canadian Open, and then at the US Open. And 2 weeks later was a tournament in LA, followed by San Francisco. And having beaten him in singles, of course, again, there's that belief of, I'm heading in the right direction. My ranking was dropping in singles and doubles, moving in a positive direction. I turned up in LA and I was looking for a doubles partner. I had been playing a bit with Wally Masur. Wally Masur wasn't at that tournament, so I wanted to sign up and play. And again, Barry would always encourage us to play. If you can get into the draw, then you sign up. And I went up to the player manager, the tour manager, Benji Robbins, and he was on the phone. And he just had this odd look on his face. I was only going to ask him if someone was looking. Did he know of someone? And, you know, he basically saw me coming and smiled and beckoned me to come closer. And then I heard him say, yes, Junior, okay. He's kind of holding the phone out, though, from his ear. And then he holds it further around. He goes, it's John McEnroe. He's really upset with me. And I said, oh, okay. Why don't you tell him that I'm looking for a doubles partner? Joking. So straight away, the phone goes back to Benji's ear and he says, hey, Junior, so you know that kid that you've lost to the last couple of tournaments? I've just seen him put his name down looking for a doubles partner. Does that interest you? And then the phone instantly went straight back out away from me. So I could just hear this loud voice. I didn't hear what he said, but it was just loud. I'm thinking, oh, yeah, he's probably telling him to, you know, you go get a new job, Benji, type of thing. What are you kidding me? But the phone call ended pretty swift after that. And Benji said he's actually thinking that might be something that is viable. I mean, my mouth just went to the floor because I really was not that serious. And I walked away thinking, big, colossal mistake, because it's easier when you're facing an opponent like McEnroe, the enigma that he was. When you're at opposite ends, you can hate that person, you can dislike them, and you don't have to look at them. And that's how I went about it playing singles. I got a call back saying that he'd agreed to play, we'd received a wild card, and I just was like, now all of a sudden I've got to like him, because I always played with people that I liked. You've got to love your doubles partner, right? You know, because you want them to support you and help you, guide you, aid you. And I hate this guy. So I turned up the next day, and I certainly felt like I was walking on air, on the clouds. I'd won my first round singles. I was in the locker room, came out after showering, and he walked in with his bag over his shoulder and these aviator sunglasses reflecting, and he just nodded to me and walked towards me. But I'm standing there completely naked, just toweling off, and he kept walking towards me. So I started to instantly feel very uncomfortable. It was like he got nose to nose with me, and he said, so you think you're good enough to play doubles with me? I said, no, but I'm going to give it a try. He goes, do you think just because you've beaten me in singles, you're good enough to play doubles with me? And I'm trying to like cover myself. It was like I never felt more naked, because in a sense, I felt like he was exposing me. He said, well, you better hold your end up, and just turned and walked off out of the lock, dropped his bag and walked out.
It's not a very loving thing to say to a doubles partner.
No. So then I'm still grappling with, do I like him or do I hate him still, you know, dislike him? Look, obviously we walked onto the court, but we had discussed, you know, probably moments before we walked on who was going to play on which side. And
because you were both ad court players, weren't you?
We were. And I take it
you deferred to him and played due court.
Of course, I deferred, you know, many times to him, but I'd never played the juice court at all. And he said that he hadn't played since a teenager on that side. And I think that probably the one thing that I might have said to him was, I think you could do okay on the juice court. You're a better player. You could play that side, right? And I believe that's the side that we stuck with. I've wanted to feel secure on the ad court.
So you played ad court and he played juice court?
Yes. We did switch sides, you know, during our partnership, but I mostly played on the ad side.
Because later you played with Martina Navratilova, who's also a legend, who is insistent on playing the ad court.
And the fortunate thing with Martina is that she turned around, she just like deferred to, well, not deferred, but she said, you need to play on the ad court. In regular scoring of mixed, she was very traditional, like the guy served first. It didn't matter in between, you know, sets, whether you've changed ends, you know, the guy always served first. And she said the big points are going to be happening on the ad court. And of course, if I hit to the guy, you know, to the fella too much, she would come over and tell me, you've got to hit to the girl. So she was a little different. But McEnroe was just, I the first set that we played, I never said a word because I was frozen. I played, you know, extremely average. He didn't really say much to me. I'd been given the idea by Barry that you are playing with one of the greatest. You need to soak up that information. Ask. Don't be shy about asking. But of course I was shy and I wasn't playing well. So that combination really, it muted me.
So what were you like as a pair by the time you got to the US Open final?
By that time I had some rotations with him as a partner where there was conversation, there was communication. I wasn't concerned with how he would perceive. I hadn't placed him on that pedestal. I felt, you know, he was my partner.
Your equal.
My equal. By then we had won a few tournaments as well. So by the time we got to the US Open, there was that idea that we could do pretty well. But that was still different from playing in LA and San Francisco. The US Open, I mean, we had Chevy Chase following us because he was a McEnroe fan. And so I had Chevy, you know, asking me these questions. I'm looking around at him going, you're that National Lampoon's dude, you know, this Saturday Night Live guy, you know, that I'd heard about. It just was an incredible atmosphere. But I learned how to play doubles from McEnroe. I ended up asking a lot of questions. He was freely answering them. And I will go back to that first time we played, though, Chris, because after the first set we lost, and I'm thinking, he's never going to play with me again. I've dropped the ball here. He nudged me in the ribs after the first set and said, hey, how you going? And I kind of looked at him and he said, just take a breath, breathe, relax. He said, I know you can play a good level of tennis. You may not be playing well today. And he said, but I still think you're a good player, even if we lose the match. And that was just like golden words for me. I started to breathe. I started to relax and things turned around pretty quickly. We ended up winning the match, going through sets 2 and 3. And the relief for me was like I had won the tournament because I'd survived that match. And so it just continually built from there. I'd asked him about playing the following week in San Francisco. He had told me, I will let you know. And when we won the first tournament, when we shook hands, he said, you've won yourself a role next week. I was like, yeah, yes, this is like a double victory. So we won the next tournament as well. And then when we ended up coming back around to the US Open, there was that success there too.
So that was the only Grand Slam men's doubles title you won with a partner other than Todd Woodbridge.
Was.
So how did you get to play with Todd?
with Todd again at the end of this partnership with McEnroe, which really didn't go beyond 12 months. I mean, we didn't play regularly. I wish we had, but he sat me down in Cincinnati and said, look, I'm not going to be playing doubles on a regular basis any longer. He said, I enjoyed it. This is not because you've done anything wrong. He said, it's just because this is my personal decision that I can't commit to playing doubles on a regular basis. But I think you need to, and you should look for an Australian. You should look for a right-hander. You should look for someone a little younger, someone that you can play who cares about singles and doubles like you do. You'll get that opportunity to play for Australia. Davis Cup is in your future. And so with each criteria that he listed, that list got smaller for me. He never said, I think you should play with Todd Woodbridge. But that name that was basically the only name that was left in my mind was Todd Woodbridge. And I knew Todd. You always know the younger generation coming up because you know that they want to supplant you, as I had done when I was coming up through the ranks.
So did you approach Todd because you were the elder one?
I was the older one by 5 years. I think it was me that first ignited the idea of playing together. We had the same management company.
Did Neil Fraser, the veteran Australian Davis Cup captain, did he have a role to play in this?
No. He was our Davis Cup captain, and I think at the start he didn't believe that perhaps we were ready to play in the first few years of the Woodies partnership. John Fitzgerald was still playing, and Fraser was always hot on Fitzy. At that stage, I was in between coaches. I had finished travelling with Barry Phillips Moore. I had focused on my physical fitness. I wanted to get stronger. Probably Neil Fraser was the one that motivated me to think about travelling with a fitness trainer, because I'd played Davis Cup a couple of times in singles, and I was able to go okay in the first match, but I wasn't bouncing back as well as my fitness needed work. So I was travelling with a trainer. I didn't have a tennis coach. Todd had Ray Ruffles traveling with him, but he didn't have a physical trainer. So when I mentioned all of this to my agent, who was Todd's agent, he said, yeah, well, this could work. So I eventually asked Todd about if there was interest, and he said yes. So it was like the jigsaw. It was a jigsaw. There were pieces of me with Todd that just came together.
And was Mark Waters your fitness coach? And that's how he became the
trainer for the Woodies, and we continued on, and the same with Ruff. So Todd had was wanting to finish or looking to move on from his junior doubles partnership with Jason Stoltenberg, and probably for Todd, he was looking for another Australian. Ruff had already said to him, great doubles teams are a lefty-righty combination. So I think he was looking for that lefty. He was looking for someone who'd had the experience of winning. That's what Todd was aspiring to do, win a Grand Slam. I had just won a Grand Slam with McEnroe. So it was just these pieces. And the first time we played together was just awful. I mean, we had played on the wrong sides. I had ended up playing with McEnroe on the Deuce Court. That's the side that I won the US Open with him on. Todd wanted to play on the ad court as well. We could not get a ball over. Even if we could shovel it, it just never went over the net. We lost badly. It just never felt synchronized. And we came off, and I think both of us kind of thought, this is not... Just that feeling wasn't there. Ruff came walking up to us. And for those who know Ray Ruffles, I mean, he's got this wicked laugh, jovial chuckle to him. We thought he was going to, you know, just give us a gobful because we had played so badly. And he just chuckled and he said, I think you guys need to play again next week and go back to your original sides. Mark, the lefty, you play the ad court. Todd, that's what you grew up playing with Stoltz on the Deuce Court. The following week we went out and played, or a few weeks later, the difference was night and day. We didn't end up winning the tournament, but the matches that we won, we knew that there was this incredible chemistry that continued right until the final match.
And yet it took you 3 years to win a major.
I don't know if it was 3 years. I mean, I think we only began in 91, Chris, so okay. by memory. So I think we went through like a 12-month period where we were winning tournaments. And then we turned up at the Australian Open, and I think we were considered outsiders, basically. But we just really couldn't wait to get out onto the doubles court. I mean, we always considered ourselves singles players, but singles was the priority. Then came doubles. But just this, we couldn't wait to get onto the court, to give it a crack on singles. And if we ended up in defeat in the singles, we were going to make a difference on the doubles court. So it was like each tournament, there was a goal that we had. And it didn't always mean or translate into winning a tournament. It was about developing our games so that we could be there, experience longevity.
You were very different personalities. And in your post-playing days, you've clashed on one or two things.
Yep.
Were you conscious of him being a very different animal to you and you being a different animal to him at that time?
I think probably I focused more on the similarities that did exist between us, as opposed to I wasn't looking for something that was different. I mean, we enjoyed travel, we enjoyed food. Even though Todd was a little younger than me, we weren't worried about having, you know, going out and having a good meal and sitting down having a glass of wine and rough, you know, that was something that he enjoyed, Muddy enjoyed. There were a lot of similarities, or what I felt. I mean, and I'm sure Todd probably felt similarities that's what helped for us to keep moving forward. In any relationship, you go through highs and lows. What we did really well was communicate those. So if I wasn't happy about something, that I felt comfortable enough that I could actually raise that issue. Not that there were that many issues, but if you felt something wasn't working, I wasn't shy about saying anything. And exactly the same with Todd. And there were times we didn't agree, but we didn't blow it out of proportion. We had a goal and we wanted to achieve that. And once we got going, we could see that we could play a part in, say, history of tennis. And the media do a very good job of that as well, by when you achieve results and you go in and do your post-tournament review and you're only three or four short of breaking this record and the last Australian team to do this, or this pair had won the most tournaments. They were all helping us reset our goals, but every year we believed we could raise our standard.
Each year, the International Tennis Hall of Fame bestows the ultimate honor in tennis to those who have set themselves apart, both on and off the court. The 260 individuals in the Hall of Fame hail from 27 countries and are enshrined in the museum at the Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island. In addition to the legacies of the Hall of Famers on display, from Dick Sears to Andre Agassi to Chrissy Evert and more, the museum boasts a stunning collection of tennis history that is open daily. Plan your trip to the International Tennis Hall of Fame at tennisfame.com/visit. Ever wonder how tennis balls were packaged in the early 1900s? Or what was fashionable on the court in 1881? How about the rackets used by Jimmy Connors or Billie Jean King? All of that and more can be found in the International Tennis Hall of Fame's digital exhibits. The award-winning digital exhibits take you through tennis's most interesting history, to the boundaries broken by black players to pave the way for today's stars. To view the digital exhibits, visit tennisfame.com/digital-exhibits. Let's send you back now to Chris Bowers for more of his conversation with Hall of Famer Mark Woodford.
I'm going to jump 5 years now to 96, because you won the Olympic gold medal. But by the time you won the gold medal, you'd won 6 Grand Slam men's doubles titles, including 4 Wimbledons. You personally had won the career Grand Slam in mixed doubles. And yet the recognition you and Todd got in Australia for the Olympic gold medal was probably greater than for any of your tennis achievements. So is that how you perceived it? And how do you look back on some phenomenal successes, Australian Open, several Wimbledons, Olympic gold, all of which would have made a career on their own?
Yeah, or 96 was our best year, and probably for me personally in singles was my most rewarding year. I think that was the year that I made the semi-finals of the Australian
it
Open
was,
as
yes.
well in singles.
I was going to come to that.
Sorry, I've jumped the gun. So I had finally cracked the top 20 in singles. And look, any time Todd and I had success in the singles, that's where the support came for each other, because we realised that if one of us was doing, we had to hope both of us could synchronise on the singles court as well, that was going to flood into our doubles. You were going to be, you know, pretty confident on the doubles court. So it was a huge season, 96. But going to the Olympics, we again felt like we had something to prove, because we had missed out on playing in 92. Neil Fraser had selected John Fitzgerald to partner Todd. We'd already been playing and had that success in the 91 season and had won the Australian Open the beginning of 92, and yet somehow we don't get picked. And that was the motivation to get to 96 to Atlanta. We were the number one team. We'd just been coming off of Wimbledon as well. And as a young kid, I'd watched every Olympics that I could, that I was cognizant of, to see the Olympic rings and to be in the village and to see all these athletes that I'd been reading about, Todd and I had been reading about. And we were so surprised when we arrived, and we were like, oh yeah, I recognize that. That's a swimmer, or that's a runner, and isn't that the hockey people? And but they were coming up to us and going, you guys are like going for gold, right? It's like, it just was like, hang on. I don't think we realized the enormity of just that Olympic fever and the team atmosphere. And I'm not saying just between Todd and I, but the whole Australian Olympic team. You're staying in your little corner of the village to go back every day to be a topic of discussion. You know, how many medals do we have? You know, you check in with everyone. And we were staying on the same dorm floor as the basketball team. And I think we had some volleyballers. Not only were we excited about our progression, but it was you'd go back in and you'd have to face this hurricane of, we got to check in with the Woodies to see whether they're still, you know, did you win? Because the gold's out there for you. The medals are there for you guys. And in a sense, I guess it feeds your ego. Gee, it felt pretty good to go back and wearing your green and gold tracksuit, the Australian uniform. But we were also ecstatic about the success of some of the other Australian, all of the Australian successes. The basketballers were doing pretty well, so we kept track on each other. And they would come out when they could. They'd come out and watch us. Ironically, Todd's sister-in-law, she was married to, ended up marrying Mark Bradkey, who was a part of the Australian team. So we knew Mark Bradkey pretty well. And then you end up, you know, kind of hanging with these dudes.
Mark Bradkey, who married Nicole Provis, who you won a couple of mixed doubles.
That's right. Yeah. So the big match for us was the semifinals against our great opposition, the Dutch guys, Elting and Haarhouse. And we were able to get through that, something like 18-16 or something. It was some huge third set. I think that's when we started to realize the gold medal was possible. I think we never really wanted to look too far forward, because it was Jaco and Paul. That's the respect we had for them. So we felt like that was the gold medal match. I mean, Atlanta was stinking hot as well. And the day that we played, I've never thought that doubles players should be reacting to a long match because it's doubles, right? So, but the heat was incredible, the humidity. I think all four of us really were feeling it out there. But we had a day off. They had to come out the next day and play for the bronze, and they just didn't have the energy. They were just crushed. That's why we felt like, you know, that was the gold medal match, and we were able to go through and win. And I think the most difficult part in the end for Todd and I after we won was making sure that we had been given halfway through the tournament the national anthem lyrics, because we'd been asked, if you guys get onto that podium and if you are, you know, you win the gold, do you know the anthem? We were like, well, not really. I said to Todd, I think I can get the first stanza. And he said, well, that's great, because I can get the second stanza. I kind of know that one. So we were given a crib sheet. And so we couldn't wait to actually, after we won, was to get that tracksuit on, to look at our crib sheet, which was just a small that we could place in the palm of our hand. We could not wait to get onto that podium and to watch the Australian flag go up, knowing that a good portion of the Australian representation, the basketball team were there, but there were a lot of other Australian Olympians that were there watching us, and I couldn't wait to sing that anthem. It was just a magical moment. And you're right, the recognition for us ran so deep. We were one of 9 gold medalists, I believe, that year. The Woodies were known back home, but I think probably in the tennis community, they knew about us.
Yes, I think it was Miloslav Matyash when he won the gold in Seoul in 88. He said, "I've had recognition for my tour events in the tennis world. Winning the Olympics gave me recognition as a sportsman."
There you go. The next few weeks, we were asked to do a lot of interviews, you know, back home in Australia. Of course, the tennis tour continued. There were other events leading up to the US Open that we were trying to prepare for as well. So we did a lot of interviews. But look, when we got back to Australia, the next time we played at home in Australia was January of 1997. It didn't matter where we played, in which city, it didn't matter which court that we played on. The crowds, it was like playing on the center court with 10,000 people. I mean, they were jamming the stairwells to come and watch us play.
And did that feel a bit weird, given that you'd won 4 Wimbledons, you'd won the Australian Open?
It was. When you play doubles, you know, it is the bridesmaids to of the singles. And even at Wimbledon, you know, when you start the match of the final, you look up at the Royal Box and it's empty because they're backstage engaging in afternoon tea after the women's singles. That's just par for the course. At other tournaments, more often than not, the doubles final was played after the singles. And so a lot of the fans were there to watch the singles players, and they didn't always stick around for the doubles. So we understood that, even though we were trying to help the tour change, you know, the idea of support for doubles. And when you have a team that is creating records, that helps bring some highlight and focus onto doubles. But this was just massively different from what we had experienced. It literally, at the Australian Open, it didn't matter. I think we might have our first match played on court 3. I think I still even have a photo. There were people on the stairs. The ushers couldn't, you know, you're supposed to keep the stairs free, but they were letting them sit in the stairs because they were out there watching the Woodies. The next match we had went on to court 1. It was still full. We ended up playing, I think, a good amount of our matches on what is now RLA. But yeah, that whole summer, we realised the importance of Olympic fever.
Fast forward 4 years to Roland Garros 2000. There's the one major that the Woodies had not won.
Yes.
And by that stage, both your wives were pregnant. Uh-huh. You were both, you know, becoming fathers. You would sort of, I think it hinted that that was going to be the end of your career. Todd was going to come back.
Yep.
So this was your last chance, and you made it.
You know, it was just a weird time. And yeah, you're right. I'd already said to Todd that I was going to retire at the end of the year. And Roland Garros was the last piece, the last jewel in this crown. Again, Todd and I, we had believed if we were going to be considered one of the great teams, you need to win all of the majors. That's first and foremost. And we hadn't achieved that. So, and I thought the Roland Garros was going to be probably the next Grand Slam that we won after our Australian Open, our first title together. I really thought Roland Garros was going to be a breeze because I loved playing in Europe. You know, I was based in Monaco. I wasn't frightened of clay. Todd, yeah, kind of, he could make adjustments, but who would have known that it was the last one for us to win? And I think probably having announced my retirement, I reckon I maybe had arrived accepting that we weren't going to win, which was very different because just about every time we turned up for a major, we started the tournament off thinking that we could win. Any player should be in that frame of mind, but that was our philosophy.
You'd won a very crucial doubles in the Davis Cup final on clay in France the previous December.
Yep.
So just 6 months earlier. Did that help you, maybe in combination with the fact that for the first time you didn't expect to win?
Yeah, it did. You're right, Chris. It did. That was significant for us because we were not exactly traveling that well in 99. It was a bit of a downer year for us. And of course, then we got to the finals of Davis Cup against the French pair, who had beaten us a couple of times. And so we were even more vulnerable on clay. We weren't shy about admitting that victories weren't coming as freely on clay. But Davis Cup, our record was, I mean, we'd lost the first match that we played. We'd won every match since, and that was going through 8-9 years. And yeah, we came back against the French pair from, you know, a set down and a break. They had set point for 2 sets to love. We had been practicing. Todd had been playing amazing. His level in practice was fantastic, and I think that's what gave me the idea, like, we could do this, because I was the one that wasn't playing well at that time. I was struggling with my serve. I just wasn't getting the desired effect, and so I'd had doubt on me. But again, the partnership shone through, because I believed Todd would be able to captain us. And with Nuke sitting on the sideline, when the match started, Todd could not hit his ass. It was like our roles had reversed. Like, all the practice paid off. I was hitting the ball well. Todd was struggling. Nuke was giving him a gobfall on the change of ends. But we saved that set point. And as it happens in doubles, the momentum quickly changed. And we came back and won well. And in celebration, had said to Todd, this makes up for such a really shitty year that we had. It makes up for everything. We just hugged each other, of course, hugged the team. And I think that really was the, like, that we, even playing average in that particular match, it dawned on us we could still come out ahead. And so coming into Roland Garros, I do think I had relaxed. I had that Roland Garros is going to come around, and there's a good chance we're not going to win this. Look, no one was really traveling with us. Only Muddy was there. Ruff wasn't with us. Aaron wasn't there. I think Natasha was there, but it was just a lot smaller group. So I think all of those elements really helped. We got through a tough match in the quarterfinals where we were down a break in the third set against Novak and Rickel, and it was a point for a double break, and I reflexed a volley back that... You know, it's one of those points you shouldn't win, but we had a way of coming out on top in those points, and that was the catalyst. We won that match, and then it just started to believe. And look, thankfully, in the final, having to play Paul Harhaus and San and Stolle, we were really, really nervous, because this is our last chance to win. And we're playing Paul, who's like, you know, geez, wish he'd retired along with Jaco. Life might have been a bit easier. But as we were waiting in just off the side of the court before they called our names out, Todd, you know, motioned to me to have a look at Sandon. Sandon was white as a ghost. It was like he was ill. Paul was saying things to him, and Sandon wasn't even responding. Todd said, whispered to me, he's like, we're playing Sandon. And we walked onto the court. I had to warm up with Sandon. He played the juice court. The first 3 or 4 balls that I hit in the warm-up, Sandon never made the court. He shanked it. It was the bottom of the net. So, again, I walked over to Todd and I said, it's continuing on. Have a look at this. And I think I just hit one ball, let Todd see it. And so every key point that we had in that match, it was directed at Sandon, and we were able to win. A lot of tears at the end of that match, a lot of emotion coming out, flooding out, because my career was winding down. We had finally won this missing piece. I think that we felt like we had legitimately staked a claim as being one of the great doubles teams.
Just a quick word about your singles career. You're obviously a legend in doubles, but you were top 20 in singles, which I know you're keen for people not to forget.
And both of us, so yeah, we still...
You were both Grand Slam semi-finalists,
yeah,
weren't you?
Yeah.
And yours came in 96, where you ambushed an Aussie hero, because Mark Philippoussis had just beaten Pete Sampras,
yes,
with the most astonishing display of power tennis.
Yep.
And then you, with your very soft game, completely phased him and got to the semi-finals.
I mean, I'd worked hard. It's not that I'd worked any different. I'd spent a little longer in the desert the preceding December, having a home in the California desert. Usually come December time, November even, you'd always go back to Australia and start preparing for the upcoming season in January. But because I was in this relationship, I was in love with Erin, my wife-to-be at that time, I wanted to spend more time in the desert. So I took most of December. I'd never done that before, but I stayed in the desert practicing at Mission Hills Country Club, spending some time with Tommy Tucker. Jose Higueras was there with the USTA, had a base at Mission Hills Country Club where I'd had my place. So I was just practicing with some different people. I mean, I'd been working my tail off. Muddy was with me, so I was on the court, but I was also doing my off-court training, and maybe it was a bit more hardcore. But, you know, by the time that I got back home to Adelaide and was preparing for that tournament in the summer, I was in the best shape that I felt of my career at that stage. And, it came together. You know, that match against Philippoussis, I had spent the night that he beat Sampras, I had watched from my hotel room with some friends. I was expecting to play Sampras, and I was kind of panicked because I'd played Pete a number of times, at least probably 10, 11 times in my career, but I'd never beaten him until that stage. And I had lost heavily a couple of times. So that was a big fear for me. And then to see Flip, you know, turn the tables and, like, you know, just absorb the power that was given to him and actually, you know, beat Pete in the power game. That's when the belief turned. I'd gone from, okay, fourth round result's not bad because I've been there before as well. I was accepting of that. But when it was Philippoussis, hang on, I can go further. I think at that stage, he was still developing and my game, just that variation, and could, you know, change the pace up enough and got the win, and then played Enquist in the quarters. I generally had a very good record against Enquist anyway, put up a good one there. But my fellow Ginge, Boris Becker, was able to handle me in the semis, but he was one guy that I'd never beaten. I took pride, as Todd did. We both semi-final singles. We both were top 20. We had both beaten some, you know, past number ones. And I think I, you know, really pride myself in the singles, that knowing that I had beaten the McEnroes, the Lendls, the Connors, the Edbergs, ended up beating Agassi and Sampras. But two guys that I never beat in my singles career was Boris Becker and Mats Wilander. So, you know, to play this match against Boris, I'd got close to him, but I just felt his power game. He could just take a swing, and I felt like it was too much for me. But that was really it preceded what was to be the best year in singles and doubles for Mark Woodford in 96.
In 2010, the International Tennis Hall of Fame decided to make its induction doubles-based. And you, alongside some great other doubles legends, were inducted. What did that mean to you?
I choked back tears when I was notified that we were going into the Hall of Fame. I was aware that 5 years after you retire, but this was 10.
You're eligible, yeah.
Yep. I think it just is like the bookend of the career, that it validates your career. The recognition, it just felt validation of the Woodies, that we were being inducted into the International Hall of Fame, and that they were stepping out of what was traditionally picking either individual doubles players who had worthy singles careers, vice versa. But this was something different, as you said, that it was a doubles year. They were recognising doubles players, doubles teams, and that we were one of them, along with Gigi Fernandez and Natasha Zvereva, who dominated through a similar time, and one of the great Australian players, Owen Davidson, through his double success. So just a thrilling, magical moment, you know, getting that call and then to be able to enjoy it with someone who I'd spent an incredible amount of time with lots of great times, you know, a close friend, and to share that time with our coach who was there, who introduced us, and with our wives, because at the time we were playing, I'd married Erin at the end of my career. Todd had, it was through the middle of our time, but we had kids. You know, couldn't have been any more special.
Mark Woodford, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and emotions on your career.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark, for all of your terrific stories and insights, and for joining us on the Tennis Worthy podcast. That is all for today, but be sure to give our other tennis-worthy podcast conversations a listen, and don't forget to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. The Tennis-Worthy podcast was created by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Brett Haber. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.